السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين نبينا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. Inshallah, today we're going to be starting the actual book that we are looking to study. And as we mentioned last week, the book that we're going to be going through is the book by Sheikh Khalid Al-Mushaiqi, one of the students of Sheikh Uthaymeen. The book is called Al-Mukhtasar fi al-Ibadat. And for those of you who weren't here last week, these lessons, hopefully, inshallah, a person can attend them individually, meaning on an individual basis. He may attend one lesson, and then he may attend another lesson in 3 weeks' time, for example, even though obviously it's encouraged for him to try to attend all of them, but he'll still benefit. So they are connected, but hopefully, inshallah, a person will benefit regardless of whether or not they're able to attend for all of them. But attendance is encouraged for all the lessons so that he can benefit fully, inshallah. And as we mentioned, this is going to be covering fiqh. And fiqh is the study of acts of worship, or the practical aspects of our deen with regards to acts of worship, with regards to mu'amalat, such as buying, selling, marriage and divorce, etc. And today, as the brother mentioned also in the announcement, we're going to be going through types of water, and we're also going to be going through hadath, the nature of hadath, which means impurities. So, of course, we're going through the acts of worship, and the first act of worship, which is the most common act of worship that we all perform on a daily basis, is the second pillar of Islam, which is the Salah. Now, these lessons that we're going to be going over, or these lessons that we're going to be teaching, they're lessons covering purification. We're not going to be covering Salah, we're going to be covering purification. Salah, as we said, is the second pillar of Islam. It's the pillar which a person practices on a daily basis. It's the act of worship which is part of our identity. As the Prophet ﷺ, he said, that al-ahd baynana wa baynahum as-salah, that the thing which defines us, the covenant that we have, that is between us and between them, that defines us as Muslims, is the Salah, it's the prayer itself. Meaning it's part of our identity as Muslims. It's what distinguishes us as Muslims compared to those who are disbelievers. So if a person was to see someone, for example, praying in the park from a distance, and he doesn't know who they are, never seen them before, and he sees a silhouette of a person praying, bowing and doing sajda, straight away you know that person is a Muslim. Straight away, you've never seen them before, you don't know who they are, and there's a bond that is connected as a result of seeing them pray. So Salah is something which is part and parcel of our identity as Muslims. And of course, so many hadith, so many virtues, ayat, mentioning the importance of Salah. The Prophet ﷺ, he spoke about Salah, and he said, As-salah, miftahul jannah, Salah is the key to Jannah, Salah is the key to paradise. And on the Day of Judgment, awwalu man yuhasabu alayhi, the first thing a person is going to be asked about on the Day of Judgment is the Salah. And if the person's salah is sound, everything else will be sound, meaning everything else will be easy after that. But if a person's salah is problematic, there's deficiencies in his salah, then everything else will be difficult after that. So if salah is the second pillar of Islam, then why are we speaking about purification and not speaking about salah? Why are we speaking about purification and not speaking about salah itself? Because in order for a person's salah to be accepted, he needs to be in the correct state of purification. So why don't we talk about wudu then? Why are we talking about water? Because in order for a person's wudu to be correct, the person has to be able to perform wudu in the correct manner. And the most primary thing when it comes to performing wudu is the kind of water that you're using in wudu. And any obligation which isn't completed except by something else, then that also becomes an obligation. As they say, ما لا يتم الواجب إلا به فهو واجب. Any obligation which cannot be completed except by something else, that also becomes an obligation. And of course, the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, ayat in the Quran, Allah says, "O you who believe, إِذَا قُمْتُمْ إِلَى الصَّلَاةِ, when you stand for salah, then essentially Allah speaks about the act of performing wudu, how to wash your hands and wash your face, etc., etc., until the end of the ayah. So wudu is a condition of making sure that your salah is a valid salah and a sound salah which is going to be accepted by Allah. And in order for a person to have sound wudu, he needs to make sure that he's performing it with the correct, in the correct manner, with the correct type of water. Some water you can perform wudu with, and some water you can't perform wudu with. And the Prophet ﷺ, he spoke about salah being the key to Jannah, and he also said in a hadith that salah, لا صلاة لمن لا وضوء له. There is no salah for the one who doesn't perform wudu. So you have to have wudu prior to performing salah. And in order for a person, as we said, to perform wudu properly, he has to be able to perform wudu with the correct water, with the right type of water. And that's why the scholars, they went into detail with regards to what kinds of water or what type of water we can do wudu with and what type of water we can't do wudu with. So they went all the way back to water itself. The nature of water, the origin of water. This water, is it permissible for a person to use? Is it not permissible for a person to use? Is it purifying, meaning can a person do wudu with it? Can a person not do wudu with it? What causes water to become impure? What makes water pure? All of these things the scholars discussed, because of course it's a part and parcel of our religion if we want to make sure that our salawat are accepted. Also, the word tahara itself, what does tahara mean? When we say purification, the chapter of purification. Yes, brother. Cleanliness. But what do we mean by cleanliness then? Cleanliness, just spiritually. Physically and spiritually. Yeah, so tahara, Islamically, when we say purification, when we say a person has to be pure when it comes to his state, in order for him to perform salah, what do we mean when we say the person has to be pure? Essentially what we're saying is that the person has to be clean from ritual and physical impurities. That's basically what we're saying. So purification means, or a person being pure, or purification, is removal of any ritual or physical impurities. So you have ritual impurities, you could call them spiritual impurities, and then you have physical impurities. Ritual impurities are impurities which you may or you may not see, okay, as opposed to the physical impurities. You could see those things. Ritual impurities are as a result of a person being in a certain state where he is unable to perform salah and he has to either perform ghusl or he has to perform wudu, one or the other, based on his state of impurity. So either he may have to perform ghusl because of him being in a state of janaba, or whatever other means that cause a person to have to be in a state of janaba, which means he has to perform ghusl, or he has to perform wudu. So either way, that's a ritual type of impurity. So you have a person in a certain state, he may be in a major state of impurity, which requires ghusl. That's called the major state of impurity. The minor state of impurity, where it's required for him to perform wudu. And then there's another type of purification, not ghusl and not wudu. What is it? Anyone know? Tayammum, yeah, tayammum. Tayammum, if there's an absence of water. One day we'll get there, inshallah, when we speak about tayammum. If there's an absence of water, or if there's a shortage of water, or if there's danger to accessing water, then a person can perform tayammum. So that's another type of purification. So you either have ghusl, or you have wudu, or you have a person performing tayammum as a result of him being in a certain state of impurity, whether it's major impurity, whether it's minor impurity, or if he performs tayammum, that could be for And again, we'll discuss this later. That could be for minor or major impurities, based on what the scholars say. So, water then. There are different types of water, as the scholars have mentioned. And the basic principle when it comes to water and using water when it comes to purification is that water is purifying, or in Arabic, tahur, it's purifying when it's in its original state. So water is something which is purifying when it's in its original state. So as long as it's in its original state, it's going to be something which is purifying. What do we mean by its original state? We mean nothing from its properties have been changed. Nothing from its properties have been changed, whereby if those properties were changed, it wouldn't be called water anymore, it would be called something else. So when something changes properties, when water changes properties, okay, and it's called something else, there are three things which change the properties of water or any liquid that change it from one thing to another. In our case, it might change water to something else. There's three things, three properties. What are those three properties which may change? The color of the water, the smell, and the taste. So, water is purifying wherever you may see it, whether it's rainwater, as Allah says, we sent down from the heavens purifying water, whether it's seawater, because it's considered to be water, it's classified as water, it's defined as water. For example, tap water, when it comes to other types of water, that water is purifying, you can do wudu with that water. The Prophet ﷺ, he said, هُوَ الطَّهُورُ مَاءُهُ الْحِلُّ مَيْتَتُهُ. About the sea water, he said, it's purifying, its water is purifying, and its dead are permissible for you to eat. So these types of water, they're purifying, you can perform wudu with these types of water. So we mentioned that if the properties change, then you can't do wudu with water if those properties change. Now, seawater is salty. So has the taste changed? Taste has changed. So if the taste has changed, how can you do wudu with seawater? It's still? Okay. So, if the taste changes, then it tastes natural as well. Don't drink too much seawater, yeah? So what do we do then? Okay, the scholars, they say, if water is classified as water and is understood to be water by the majority of people, then it's still water regardless of if the taste changes. For example, tap water. What do we have in our tap water? Chlorine. Okay, so does the taste change? Yeah, if you drink tap water, the taste doesn't taste the same. Maybe if you go to certain cities, it's probably worse or better, depending on where you go. But there's chlorine in the water. So the taste has changed slightly, but it's still understood and categorized as water. No one's going to say this isn't water. If I'm at somebody's house and I ask for water, and they get some tap water and they give it to you, I'm not going to say, what is this? I ask for water, you give me something else. It's understood that this is water. Also, hadith that speak about the seawater being purifying, etc. So if it's classified as water, even if some of those properties change, if it's still considered to be water, if it's still classified as water by, you know, the awam, the general people, if it's still understood to be water, then a person can do wudu with it. For example, in the time of the Prophet ﷺ, Aisha radiallahu anha, she said that we used to live off al-aswadan. We used to live off the two black things. That's what she used to call it. And that those two things were dates and water. She called water the two black things. Because if you think about it, in those days, the wells, there was no purification system, there were no filters or anything. So the water they used to use in those days wasn't like the crystal clear water we use. It was essentially like murky water. But it was still considered and classified as water. It was still considered water. But of course, the circumstances and the in those days, you know, the level of technology and, you know, modernity that we have today, the modern technology we have, changes the way it looks, but it's still classified and considered water in the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So that's one thing. Even if properties of something which is classified as water do change slightly, as we just given the example, chlorine or something else, salt water, if the properties do change slightly, but it's still considered to be water, then a person is still permitted to perform wudu with that water, or to do ghusl with that water. In the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, for example, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam would order the women from the companions to wash the dead with water mixed with sidr leaves from the low tree, for example, and other types of things that they would use in those days that were purifying. So water would be mixed with certain things, but the property of the water, even though it may look slightly different, it was still considered to be water. Okay, so if the property does change to the extent where it's not classified as water anymore, then of course you can't perform wudu with that specific water. Okay, and we mentioned the three properties. If it's the smell that changes, if it's the taste that changes, if it's the color that changes, then it's not permissible for a person to perform wudu with that. So that's with regards to the properties, and the properties changing the state of water. And as we said, if there's a slight amount of change, something small has been added to the water, but it's still considered water, okay, then you can still perform wudu with that specific water. So the scholars, they say, with regards to water, they categorize it into two. They categorize water into two. And some categorize it into three, but we'll focus on two. The first category is tahur, which basically means purifying. So you have purifying water. Purifying water is water that you can perform wudu with. So if water is tahur, that means you can perform wudu with that water. So if it's purifying water, you can perform a wudu with that water. And we said before, water in its original state is considered to be purifying. If there's nothing impure which has been added to that water, which changes the properties of that water, be it the taste or the smell or the color, then you can still perform wudu with that water, because the impurity was so insignificant that it wouldn't actually change the properties of the water itself. So you have purifying water, water which you can perform wudu with. Then you have water which is najis, the second category, which is impure water. So water which you cannot perform wudu with, and it's water which you cannot use if its color changes, if its properties change, the color, the smell, or the taste. And in this case, it would be considered impure. You wouldn't be able to use it. Now, some of the scholars, they divide water into three categories. They say there's purifying water, and then there's impure water you can't use, and then they say there's tahir water. Water which is tahir, which means pure, meaning you can use that water, but you can't use it specifically for wudu or for ghusl. Okay, basically that means any water which has been mixed with another substance where it changes its state, and now you can't use it for wudu, but you may be able to, for example, drink it. So for example, tea. Okay, tea is 90% water. Yeah, if you don't have milk, then it's even more. And if you put tea bags into a cup of water or a mug of water, it changes its property. But it's still predominantly water. But what you've done now is you've changed the property to such an extent where it's not considered to be water anymore. It becomes tea. Same thing with other liquids. If the taste changes, then you can't perform wudu with that water, because now its properties are something else. Okay, you have a bottle, for example. It looks like water, the label's gone, you don't know what it is. It looks like water, okay? But when you open the bottle top and you smell it, it smells like lemonade. The smell's changed, so you can't perform wudu with that water because one of the properties has changed, okay? It might look like water, okay? It might smell, it might not have any smell, okay? Just like water doesn't have a smell normally. And then when you drink it, you realize it's some kind of chemical. Okay, and then you spit it out and you're not going to drink it because it's going to cause harm. So that's obviously the taste which has changed, so you won't be able to perform a wudu with that specific water. So some of the scholars, they divide it into three categories. So they say a person will have purifying water that he can do wudu with, a person has impure water which he can't use for anything, and a person will have pure water which he can use for cooking, drinking, eating, etc. Yeah, cooking oil, milk, these are all types of water. They're liquids essentially. But in our circumstances, in our situation, there will be considered different types of water because they're liquids essentially. So all these types of things would be considered pure, but we are going to be categorizing them into two. Because what are we focusing on? We're focusing on the validity of our wudu. That's what we're focusing on. So if it's not valid for us to be able to do wudu with, then it's not, doesn't matter whether it's, you know, orange juice or tea or anything else. It doesn't make a difference if it's got something impure in it. Ultimately, if it's tahur and we can do wudu with it, that's what we want to know. Otherwise, it's not something which is valid for us to use with regards to our wudu. So water is two types. You have purifying water and you have impure water. Now, what happens if a person isn't sure whether the water is pure or impure? So he sees the water seems fine, the color seems fine, it seems like, you know, the taste is fine, there's no smell to the water, but, you know, maybe someone said something or it's in a certain area and he's not sure, some doubt entered his heart and he's not sure whether or not the water is pure, is purifying or not purifying. Like purifying or impure, tahur or najis. What does he do in this situation? Assume it's pure. Why? Okay, so the famous principle. You assume that water is pure if you have water in front of you and it looks like water, tastes like water, smells like water, like there's no smell to it. And, you know, there's some doubt in your heart that it may be impure. Then the principle that you use is the famous fiqh principle, an Islamic principle, al-yaqeen la yazulu bishak, that certainty isn't removed by doubt. Certainty isn't removed by doubt. That's the principle we use. And this is such an important principle. You can use it in so many things, whether it's wudu, whether it's salah, whether it's tawaf, for example. Certainty isn't removed by doubt. So you have water present somewhere, okay, let's say you're hiking or whatever the case is, and you see some water, you're not sure if the water is pure or impure. So what do? You stick to the decision based on what you are sure of, what you are certain of. As far as you're concerned, as far as you can see, and also the basic principle of water generally being purifying. This is the general principle of water anyway, that water is purifying. So as far as you're concerned, the water is purifying. Nothing has caused that water to become impure. You could say, well, something may have happened, you know, an hour before I came, or something could have happened a week ago, but then you could say that about anything. You could say that about any kind of water. There's a possibility of something contaminating some water somewhere at some point in time. And so if that was the case, then the person would never do wudu again. Because there's always going to be some doubt. So the basic principle, in order for a person to remove doubt, is that he sticks to what he's certain of. Anything which causes doubt, he just brushes it aside. And there's a narration of Umar ibn Khattab radiallahu an, when he was walking with one of the companions, and there was a drain, or there was, you know, a broken drain or something, and water was splashing, and some of the water went onto Umar radiallahu an. And the other companion with him, he spoke to the owner of the water, of the drain pipe. And he asked him, what do you think he asked him? Is this water pure or is it impure? He wants to know, because obviously if it's impure, then they need to do wudu, they need to clean the clothes, etc. Umar ibn Khattab told the companion to remain silent, don't ask this question. And he told the man, you don't need to answer. And they just carried on walking. Very interesting. He told the man, don't answer the question. And don't ask that question. And he just moved on. Why? To avoid the issue of doubts. To open up a door where you're making it difficult. There's no need. We just move along. And assume, based on the principle that water is purifying in its natural state, we're going to assume the water is purifying. Khalas, job done. No need to delve into, you know, this issue and make things harder for ourselves. We're going to just leave it there. Don't make things harder for yourself. You know, as they say, ad-din yusr, the deen is ease. There's no difficulty and hardship when it comes to religion. So that narration also helps us with regards to this point, and also the principle that certainty isn't removed by doubt. Certainty isn't removed by doubt. The opposite could also be the case. So water is considered impure. You come across water and it's impure, but some people have told you that for whatever reason, the water was purified, it's not impure anymore. But it's in its original state, from what you know, from what you saw, let's say an animal did something in the water, for example, or a human being, okay? You saw that. So you're certain the water is pure or impure? You're certain the water is impure. You saw someone doing something in the water, or an animal doing something in the water. So you're certain it's impure, okay? You're doubtful whether or not the water is pure. So certainty isn't removed by doubt. So you stick to what you're certain of, which is that the water is impure. And this is a beautiful Islamic principle that we can apply in so many aspects of our deen. When it comes to ibadah, also when it comes to our aqidah, by the way. Ibadah, for example, salah, is something we probably do anyway, ourselves. When do we apply this principle in salah? So what do you do then? Let's say not sure if you prayed 3 or 4. So what do you got feeling? So the principle is certainty isn't removed by doubt. If you're doubtful whether or not you performed 3 rak'ahs or 4 rak'ahs, okay, what are you certain of? You're certain that you've done 3. Because that's the lower number. You're certain you've done 3. You're unsure whether or not you've done 4. So you stick to what you're certain of, which is that you basically say in your mind, khalas, I've done 3, I'm going to pray 1 extra rak'ah. What if you happen to have done 4, but now you ended up praying 5 because of this? It's excused, you're excused. Because you follow the principle, and obviously you weren't sure. So you won't be held accountable. Okay, and plus you wouldn't remember anyway, because that's the whole point, you've forgotten. So if you're unsure whether you prayed 3 or 4, certainty isn't removed by doubt, so you pray an extra 1, and you complete your 4, basically, as far as you're concerned. Okay, with tawaf, same thing. With tawaf, same thing. A person is doing tawaf, and he's unsure if he's done 5 circuits or 6 circuits. Okay, he sticks to what he's certain of, which is that he's done, for sure he knows he's done at least 5, the next one will be 6, not 7. So, this is an Islamic principle which is used amongst the scholars. It's something which is very common. Also, it's something which can be used with regards to our deen, with regards to our belief in Allah, with regards to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Because, of course, we make dua for thabat, we make dua that Allah keeps us, you know, firm in our deen, but sometimes a person ends up having certain doubts, and some people more than others. A person may read a hadith and he may have doubts about certain incidents, certain aspects, certain cases that occurred in the lifetime of the Prophet ﷺ. And maybe Shaitan will throw some doubt into his heart. But he still believes in the Kalima, still believes that Muhammad is the Messenger of Allah. So the problem that some people have is they find some things they don't understand, they never studied, they're not aware of the whole circumstances of what they read from the seerah of the Prophet ﷺ, for example. And then they throw, as they say, the baby out with the bathwater, meaning the whole deen just becomes invalid for them because of certain doubts that they had. So even things they were sure of, they throw out with everything that, with the things that they were doubtful of. The Islamic principle is, if a person hears something, he's unsure, you know, he's not finding an answer, he may be doubtful about something, it shouldn't remove, in its common sense, it shouldn't remove something which he's completely certain of. It doesn't make any sense. The Book of Allah, certain ayat, which a person may not understand. He doesn't understand the hikmah, the wisdom of. Our knowledge is limited. We may, you know, we ask Allah for protection, but we may have certain doubts. Some people may have certain doubts about some ayat. But it shouldn't negate the certainty the Muslim has with regards to the speech of Allah, with regards to the barakah, with regards to the beauty, with regards to the miraculous nature of the Quran, its preservation, etc., etc. So to, you know, completely throw away the whole validity and the miracle of the Quran because of some things he has doubt of goes against common sense. Because certainty shouldn't be removed by doubt. Al-yaqeen la yazulu bishak. Certainty is not removed by doubt. So it's a beautiful principle. Same thing with the belief in Allah. People, for example, they question Allah's existence. Atheism is a big thing, big problem. You know, they'll have a few questions, and now they'll completely deny the existence of God, even though the signs are all around them. Again, certainty isn't removed by doubt. It doesn't make any sense. You have a few issues, a few questions about the creation, you know, about the universe, about God that you don't understand. And naturally, you won't understand because your knowledge is limited anyway. You're not going to understand everything in the first place. But then to throw everything out, your whole belief of a creator is something which, again, doesn't make any sense. Again, the principle, certainty isn't removed by doubt, comes into play. So it's a very important principle that everyone should learn, everyone should understand, and everyone should, inshallah, benefit from. So that's basically with regards to water, okay? Purifying water and impure water. Some water a person can do wudu with if the properties haven't changed, the water, the smell, the taste, and the color. And impure water, if something impure enters into that water, then it's not permissible for a person to perform wudu with that water. So that's with regards to water. Now, inshallah, we're going to move on to the ruling with regards to vessels. So, of course, water, especially in the olden days, water was stored in vessels. Certain vessels, if water is in those vessels, then a person isn't permitted to perform wudu with that water. And it's something which is in books of fiqh. They speak about ahkamul aniya, the rulings with regards to vessels. And aniya basically is a vessel which carries water, a vessel which carries food or drink, any vessel, could be anything. But depending on the vessel, it may be something which is permitted for a person to do wudu with if it's in that vessel or it's impermissible. And the basic principle when it comes to vessels, just like if a person was to see water, is that he assumes that the vessel is clean so long as there's nothing there which makes a person question otherwise or think otherwise. So the basic principle is that something is clean or something is, you know, permissible or something is valid. And that's based on another principle in Islam, which is al-aslu fil ashya al-ibaha, which means the origin of something is that it's permissible. The origin of something is that it is permissible. Okay, that's with regards to things which aren't acts of worship. Very important point. So this principle that everything, al-aslu fil ashya al-ibaha, the origin of everything is that it's permissible is with regards to things which are not considered acts of worship. Anything which isn't an act of worship, is it permissible? The basic ruling would be yes, unless proven otherwise. Because deen is a deen of ease. Okay? This idea that people have of Islam making everything haram, it's not the case. Food, for example, everything is halal unless stated otherwise in the Quran. If you think about food, you think about different types of food we're allowed to eat. We're allowed to eat a lot of different types of food, different kinds of meat, and you know, fruits and vegetables, etc. There's only a few things which are haram, really. But again, this principle applies to things which are not considered acts of worship. Acts of worship, this isn't an act of worship, by the way. We're speaking about wudu, but this point here is speaking about water being in a vessel. So this in and of itself isn't an act of worship. It's just water being in a vessel. Is the vessel, you know, clean or not clean? Okay, the asl is al-ibaha, that is permissible. The opposite would be the case when it comes to acts of worship. For example, a person comes into the masjid and he wants to pray and he starts his salah, and instead of making takbir, he makes tasbih. He says, Subhanallah. And then he goes into sajda straight away, then stands up, then goes into a second sajda, and then gives salam, then stands up and reads Surah Fatiha. And you say, brother, what are you doing? And he says, I'm praying. Say, you can't pray like this. Why? Because it's not permissible. You have to pray a specific way. Meaning, in acts of worship, everything is actually haram. Unless there is evidence on the contrary. So a person can't pray any way he wants, there's a specific way. He can't perform tawaf how he wants, there's a specific way. He can't give zakah any way he wants, there are specific guidelines and things he has to do. Fasting likewise, he can't just do it however he wants. If he does it however he wants, it may be invalid. He has to pray in a specific way. He has to perform wudu in a specific way. So the basic principle when it comes to acts of worship is everything is haram unless proven otherwise. And with other acts, not acts of worship, okay, a person walking, talking, eating, sleeping, playing, whatever, okay, the asal is al-ibaha. What does ibaha mean? It comes from the word mubah. Mubah means permissible. So it's in the middle. So, for example, you will have things which are compulsory, wajib. Then beneath that you have things which are disliked. Then in the middle, or not disliked, sorry, you would have wajib, then you would have recommended. So wajib, recommended. Recommended is sunnah, for example, or mandub. You could say sunnah or mandub, either one. So things are either wajib, they're obligatory, or they're recommended, or it would be mubah. Neither. You wouldn't be rewarded for it, you wouldn't be punished for it. It wouldn't be encouraged or discouraged, like eating, just generally a person eating, or walking, or a person sleeping. Generally speaking, these things are mubah. You're not going to be rewarded for them or sinful for them. Then you have, below mubah, makruh, which is something which is disliked, and then obviously the last one, haram. So mubah, my point is mubah is in the middle. Mubah is in the middle. And when it comes to vessels, okay, the basic ruling is that it's permissible. Vessels are permissible unless stated otherwise. What's the evidence that everything is permissible? Allah in the Quran, He says, هُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ لَكُم مَّا فِي الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا. He is the one who created for you everything that is on the earth. And that's a general ayah. Allah is saying, for you is everything that has been created on earth. It's all for you. For you to use, for you to, you know, do whatever you wish with. So that's the basic principle. But then of course, depending on the rulings, depending on if it's ibadah, if it's worship or otherwise, it may become haram, it may be something which is encouraged, all based on the circumstances. So with regards to vessels then, things which will have vessels which will have liquid stored in them, water, for example, in our case when it comes to wudu. The basic principle is that everything is permissible. Every vessel is permissible, with the exception of a few things. Any vessels which are made of gold or silver are vessels which are not permissible for a person to eat or drink from. So stored, water stored in them, okay, food eaten from a plate which is gold, which is a gold plate. These things are considered extravagant. They're things which are not permitted, and they are considered to be haram. So it wouldn't be permissible for a person to use gold and silver plates, gold and silver vessels. It wouldn't be permissible for a person to put wudu water in those vessels and to do wudu from those vessels, because they're vessels which are of gold or of silver. And the Prophet ﷺ, he said, لَا تَشْرَبُوا فِي آنِيَةِ الذَّهَبِ وَالْفِضَّةِ. Don't drink from vessels which are of gold or silver, and don't eat from those either. فَإِنَّهَا لَهُمْ فِي الدُّنْيَا, because it's for them in the dunya, وَلَكُمْ فِي الْآخِرَةِ, and it's for you in the akhirah. So it's a clear hadith showing us the impermissibility of eating and drinking from those vessels, and min babi awla, even more of a priority when it comes to performing wudu and using them for specific acts of worship. There would be an exception though, and that exception would be two exceptions. If it's not real gold or silver, then it would be permissible. If it's gold plated but it's not actual gold, then it would be permissible. And if those vessels were damaged, cracked, for example, and then gold or silver was used to basically mend those cracks, like solder was used, okay, but the solder was from gold or silver, okay, to mend and repair a vessel, then also in that case, it would be permissible. There are narrations which mention the Prophet ﷺ had some vessels and which were damaged, and then they were repaired with gold or silver. And they were being used for these purposes. So if it's a case of it being repaired, then in that case, it would be permissible. Otherwise, it wouldn't be permissible for a person to use these when it comes to performing wudu or eating and drinking from. What about the vessels of disbelievers? Is it permissible to use vessels of let's say you go to your neighbor's house and he's a non-Muslim and he gives you some food. Sorry? You wash them? So you go to your neighbor's house, he gives you food. You say, one minute, let me just go to the kitchen and wash this, and then what do you think? You can use it? Why? Who's saying you can use it? Why? But you don't know. That's the problem. You don't know. You went to your neighbor's house. Excellent. Al-yaqeen la yazulu bishak. Certainty isn't removed by doubt. The scholars, they say that if you go to a person's house, you would assume that the vessel is pure, because certainty isn't removed by doubt. That's the general principle. The general principle would be that it's considered to be pure. Unless you saw that something was in that vessel which was obviously najis or impure, alcohol or something else. Otherwise, you assume that the water or the vessel is considered pure. A person says Bismillah and, you know, he eats whatever he's given. Because the Prophet ﷺ, once he was given food by a Jewish man. And of course, you know, they would have the alcohol, they would have things that were impure. You know, they wouldn't eat things which were pure all the time. So the Prophet ﷺ, he was given this food from a Jewish man and he ate the food. He didn't clean the vessel or anything. So in that case, it's considered mubah also, unless, of course, as we mentioned, you can see that something impure was in there. Then, of course, it would be considered impure. What about having gold and silver vessels, but not for the purpose of eating and drinking? If it's not for the purpose of eating and drinking, what would be the purpose of having it? Sorry? Decoration. Yeah, so you go to some cultures, okay, and decorate the, you know, houses with gold plates, gold and silver plates, gold and silver vessels. It's common in some parts of the world. In that case, the scholars differ, but they say it's better not to use them for purposes of decoration. it's better not to. So they say in those situations, even if it's not used for eating and drinking, if it's just for purpose of decoration, they say it's better if a person doesn't use it for those purposes. Because the hadith mentions that it's for you, it's for them in this world, and it's for you in the akhirah. These vessels are for them, but it's for you in the akhirah, meaning it's better to avoid and not to use them. So that's with regards to vessels and with regards to types of water. And also with regards to using certain types of vessels, in those days, for example, they would use leather. So any animal, for example, if the skin is tanned, then it becomes leather, and that leather would be permissible for a person to use for carrying water, obviously with the exception of lahm al-khinzir, with the exception of pigskin. Otherwise, other types of leather would be permissible for a person to use when it comes to water and containing water and carrying water. So with this, inshallah, we're going to be concluding for this session. And next lesson, we're going to be going through what is forbidden for the impure to do. So if you're in a state of impurity, what are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to do? Where are you allowed to go? What are you allowed to touch? What are you not allowed to do if you're in a state of hadith, in a state of impurity? And we'll be dealing with that next lesson, inshallah. And then in the future, we'll be speaking about etiquettes of using the bathroom, using the siwak. Then we'll talk about wudu a few weeks later, inshallah. So with that, inshallah, we're going to be concluding. Any questions before we conclude? Yes, brother. So generally speaking, a person using jewelry, the Prophet ﷺ, he raised gold and silk, and he said, "Inna hadani haraman ala dhukuri ummati." These two things, gold and silk, are haram for the male members of my ummah. Which means if a person uses silver in his ring, for example, that would be permissible. So it's permissible for a person to wear silver rings. There's nothing wrong with a person doing this from an Islamic perspective. With regards to wedding rings, this is something which is from the practices of the non-Muslims. If a person is wearing a ring, the Prophet ﷺ himself used to wear a ring, and even then the scholars differ whether or not it's something which is a sunnah. Some scholars do say it's a sunnah. If a person wears a ring because he wants to follow the sunnah of the Prophet, then that would be permissible. With regards to wedding rings, this is something which is from the acts of the disbelievers, and it would be better if a person avoids that. Allah knows best. Best to be avoided, and in some cases, scholars say it's haram also. Yeah, so another point I forgot to mention. If a person is wearing a watch and it's not gold, but it's gold-plated, for example. So the same thing, you might think it's, not you specifically, I'm just saying everyone. So a person might assume that it's fine because it's not gold. It's gold-plated. But the problem is other people will think and assume that it's something which is gold. So again, the scholars say it technically may not be haram, but it's better for a person to avoid. So the brother's asking about water, which is sparkling water. Again, the taste has changed. Yeah, because the taste has changed because of the gas, so it wouldn't be permissible to do wudu with that water. Allah knows best. But if it's not sparkling, it's fine. Yeah, because it's mineral water, bottled mineral water, that's fine. That's water. But if it's sparkling, Allah knows best, I don't think it would be permissible. But I'll confirm next week, inshallah. As far as I know, I don't think it would be permissible. Yeah, so the brother's asking about water. Sometimes from the tap, it might change color because of certain issues. Again, if it's considered to be water, then inshallah, it would be permissible for you to do wudu with it, even if the color changes slightly. Yeah, again, like we said, if there is some kind of change, but it's still considered to be water, and it hasn't changed into something else, then it would be permissible, inshallah. Yes, brother. Yeah, that's what you mentioned. So because it looks like gold, it would be discouraged. Yeah. But technically, it wouldn't be gold, but it's because it looks like gold. No. Well, which point was that? So if it's inside the vessel, then the vessel, if there's water inside the vessel, the water would be pure water, purifying water. You can do wudu with that water. But for example, if the vessel is impure in its nature, like pig skin, then it wouldn't be permissible. If it's water in a gold or silver vessel, then again, that would be impermissible. Then it would be permissible, yeah. So if you take it out and put it into another vessel, then it would be permissible. Okay, jazakumullah khair. Subhanakallahumma bihamdika ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.